You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2016. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the multi-billion pound real cost of Brexit for the UK. We'll be discussing why taking back control is proving to be a somewhat longer game than anticipated as far as the UK economy is concerned.
An economy which has confounded commentators at home and abroad with its strength and its resilience since the British people decided exactly 5 months ago today to leave the European Union and chart a new future for our country.
My guests Michael Goldfarb and Victor Bulmer-Thomas will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including President-elect Donald Trump's latest cabinet picks. Do we have any idea what he's doing yet? Does he? Colombia's government thanks the people for their input and goes ahead with a modified peace deal. And how much would your life be changed by a laundry-folding robot? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, the journalist, author, and broadcaster, and Victor Bulmer-Thomas, associate fellow in the US and the Americas program at Chatham House. Welcome both. And we will start tonight in the UK, where the bills for this summer's decision to leave the EU at some still-to-be-specified juncture have begun to arrive. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, has estimated the dent put in public finances over the next 5 years at £59 billion. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, meanwhile, has candidly assessed the outlook for workers' pay as dreadful. It may be another 5 years before real wages are equivalent to what they were in 2008. Victor, is it possible that the so-called Project Fear didn't go far enough?
No, because the public had become immunized to those sorts of predictions. And what we're seeing now is some of them coming true. But of course, we really don't know how many of them will come true, because forecasting is always an impossibly difficult thing to do. And to do it in this context, when there are so many uncertainties, is even more difficult. So maybe the growth rate next year and the year after will be much lower, and that will certainly have a hit on the public finances and so on. But once you get into 2019, 2020, it's really difficult to say. It could be lower than what the Chancellor outlined yesterday. It could be higher. It could be somewhere in the middle. But frankly, I wouldn't put a lot of importance on what people are saying about that far out.
Michael, is it? I mean, that's almost certainly true, that I think before the vote and since the vote, people have believed whichever set of figures they have preferred to believe. But Michael, is it possible to imagine the set of forecasts or circumstances so grim that they might cause a plurality of Leave voters to wonder if it had been such a smart idea?
No, I think pretty much agree with Victor. The prognostication processes, I mean, prognostication is wrong. The data that's presented with some interpretation of what they mean for the short to medium term by groups like the OBR and internationally the OECD have had a very rugged decade since the crash. I mean, the OECD's predictions about what was about to happen across the Eurozone haven't necessarily come true, and they're constantly having to reassess them. And I think that, you know, in British public opinion, people are in their silos, and we're still operating in the period of the phony war, in that the negotiations haven't begun. We have no sense really of what it is, what the process might even be once Theresa May triggers Article 50, if she indeed does it before March of next year, which is what she's announced she will do. And until that happens, I don't think any data that you collect can be interpreted in any reasonable manner, because you don't know what the real cost of leaving the European Union will be. We don't know, for example, here's a simple thing. You know, the UK is committed to all manner of projects and funding that goes on for a long, long time. If the UK chooses to leave in 2 years, the UK might still be liable for these amounts of money, and they're not small amounts of money. How will that affect the public purse? Well, we don't know, because we don't know where we are in the negotiations, because they haven't started yet.
Victor, a deeply hilarious detail in the autumn statement was the estimate that lower migration will add £16 billion to the bill over the next 5 years. Why hasn't the message about migration and the economy ever been able to stick? Because every analysis ever undertaken that I'm aware of demonstrates that migrants, myself among them, I'd like to think, are net contributors to a nation's economy.
Well, lots of people did make that point, both in the referendum campaign and before that, and indeed subsequently. But of course, people's attitudes towards migration is a function of many things. One is economics, one is culture, and one is psychology. And unfortunately, culture and psychology seem to have trumped economics. And so coming up with these numbers like yesterday, and let's face it, even that number is very difficult to say whether it's accurate or not. But even a number like that isn't going to change people's minds if they've voted to control migration for either cultural or psychological reasons.
What does happen, though, Michael, if things do get noticeably and perceptibly grimmer and public opinion actually does start to noticeably and perceptibly shift?
Well, then you'll find that, you know, the drama, which is far from finished, will carry on, and you'll begin to get real calls for a second referendum. And the same people who, you know, would doubtless have been calling for a second referendum if they had lost, meaning, you know, Nigel Farage, who may be moving to America.
That's one vote Leave won't get that, in a rerun.
Exactly. But I mean, your folks like Nigel Lawson, who's well struck in years, and, you know, in 3 or 4 years may not get a vote either. look, you know, Daniel Hannan, the whole rogues gallery of folk will, you know, they would never have accepted 52-48 if it had gone for Remain. And so, you know, the ones who lost this time will, you know, see where public opinion might be in 3 years, three more years of, you know, I mean, Tory governments don't lack, you know, give them an excuse. They will continue austerity, you know, wages. You know, I always think that wages are going to be depressed under Tory administrations because, well, the things that workers have at their disposal to perhaps bargain and get a better wage have long since been destroyed, like trade unions and so on. So I think that it's still all to play for. But I, you know, as I say, every time I'm asked on any broadcast forum, can we stop talking about it until there's a bloody negotiation going on?
We can put that to the people in charge, certainly. But on that note, we will turn now to the United States, where however many times you wake up, Donald Trump still appears to be president-elect. In the last few days, Trump has named or strongly hinted at more nominees to his cabinet, names which suggest that either he actually is going to form an inclusive government or merely enjoys annoying the people who doubted that he would. Two women, both previously critical of Trump, have been named: South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to the UN, billionaire Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary, and Trump's former rival for the nomination, Ben Carson, is believed to be in line for Housing and Urban Development. Victor, by my estimation, if you leave out the Vice President and Chief of Staff, he has now nominated six cabinet-level positions nominated, two of them women, one of those women born in India, and a black man. Does Donald Trump at least get a round of applause for a remarkably diverse cabinet so far?
Well, it's a nice try, but I'm not sure that you could quite spin it like that. More to the point is the lack of experience, and what is, I think, puzzling is that even when a candidate has a certain amount of expertise and experience, like Ben Carson in medicine, he hasn't put him in that role. As for Nikki Haley's credentials in terms of foreign policy, I would think they were close to zero. It's true that DeVos has some experience in education, but it's probably not the sort of experience that would thrill many on the Democrat side, but it may please quite a lot of them on the Republican side.
Michael, Ben Carson, I still haven't quite figured out what to make of him, because obviously at the thing he does, he is an indisputable genius. He is a great surgeon, and that is a very difficult and very praiseworthy thing to be. 2 weeks ago, however, he said he didn't want a cabinet post because he had no experience in government, which did not, of course, stop him running for president. But while running for president, I don't know, he just seemed strange and detached and not really all there.
His public persona is odd, to say the least. But he does do radio. I mean, he does broadcast, and he does do neurosurgery. I suppose that kind of preternatural calm.
It always seems to me
like he's on 500 milligrams of Xanax an hour. Have you ever? I mean, seriously. I mean, he's just that tranquilized. I think the interesting thing. The New York Times headline is "Diversify," is showing diverse cabinet, and it just goes to show why diversity goals, have become, I mean, their own noose around the neck of progress in a sense, because Donald Trump doesn't. I'm sure that was a consideration when he thought of who he was going to bring into his cabinet. There's Nikki Haley. She is, the daughter of South Asian immigrants. Her politics are those of, that class of immigrants who make it and think we made it in spite of all the prejudices. You don't need any help. We did it. You can do it. I don't see that as a diversity hire. Betsy DeVos came from wealth. Her brother is Eric Prince, who founded the notorious mercenary firm Blackwater. It's not called Blackwater anymore because it was so notorious they keep rebranding it and giving it different names. He now lives, last heard from, in the Gulf, running Mercs for whoever can pay. And she married into the Amway fortune. She comes from a very different, I won't say strange, but different Calvinist sect, whose previous most famous person was Paul Schrader, the film director, who made a radical break with them and became a completely dissolute member of New York's bohemian society. So she comes at education from an extremely Christian point of view. And I think her overview is that everybody should get a voucher that will be paid for from central government, and then you can pay to go whatever kind of school you want to. And, this would include religious schools, where the curriculum would include things like, I don't know, Noah's Ark, and the fact that the world is only 6,000 years old, and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's actually an incredibly retrograde thing, but it's seen as progressive in the New York Times because she is a woman.
Nikki Haley, Victor, you mentioned, has no noticeable foreign affairs experience, but she's certainly not, as I think a lot of people might have anticipated, a sort of doctrinaire UN-bashing headbanger of the sort that America has occasionally sent to the UN, as George W. Bush famously did with John Bolton, for example. Is there perhaps a suggestion of ability or willingness to compromise there from Trump? And again, Nikki Haley is somebody with whom he rowed quite publicly during the campaign. She said pretty mean things about him. He said she was an embarrassment to South Carolina, and now he's given her a fairly high-profile job.
Well, I think it all depends on who the Secretary of State is, because in Washington, foreign policy is conducted by a series of individuals and indeed departments, and the balance between them is often crucial as to deciding, who wins. And you saw that very clearly when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and Obama was president. And each of them would have their favored policies, and sometimes they would clash, and it wasn't automatically clear who would come out on top. Now, I would have thought the problem for Nikki Haley is, given her lack of experience, And the fact that she hasn't necessarily bashed the UN doesn't mean that she thinks the UN is a good thing. It probably just means she hasn't thought about it very much, because there's no particular reason for her to have done so, to be honest. But now she will have to think about it. But I would have thought she will take her lead either from the Secretary of State or possibly from Trump, depending how interested he is in foreign affairs. And we frankly don't know the answer to that.
I mean, Michael, is it the Secretary of State nomination that will tell us the most about how Trump sees his presidency, certainly as it interacts with the rest of the world? Because there's been an extraordinary range of names linked with it, from, you know, Mitt Romney to Rudolph Giuliani to Newt Gingrich. Even David Petraeus's name has come up once or twice, Richard Armitage, etc., etc.
I don't think he knows, and I don't think anyone knows, but it's hard to say until we get about, you know, 100 days into his actual administration, which would put us in, I don't know, May, end of May next year. But I still get the sense that he will be the ultimate arbiter on this, on stuff. And I do think that he's been so unconventional in everything he's done so far. I think that there'll be two or three people, his son-in-law, famously Jared Kushner, Steve Bannon, who will have his ear in ways that these cabinet appointments, particularly Secretary of State, will think that they're running the State Department, but the crucial decision-making will come out of the White House, and it will be chaotic decision-making. There won't be a clear line. I mean, the Secretary of State is not likely to know what Donald Trump is thinking. I'm just hazarding that as a guess. I think he will. When I saw Mitt Romney turn up, it seemed to me it's exactly the kind of thing he would do, because he knows that the real decisions, how he relates to Vladimir Putin, what happens in Syria, will come out of the White House and the National Security Council and not out of state. And in that respect, these could end up being increasingly, what's the word I'm looking for? Help me, Victor. For show. For show is too cheap a word.
Cosmetic.
Cosmetic. That's the word.
A Potemkin, yes. Cabinet.
I think the potential for Potemkin is very high. You know, considering that he basically ran his campaign himself, and they had to physically remove the Twitter account from him so that in the last 2 weeks of the campaign he didn't commit a gaffe that might have cost him the election. I think he's... The whole thing is his show, and he thinks he produces it better than anybody else.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Victor Bulmer-Thomas. Coming up next, a government goes ahead with something despite a referendum result. It's a thought.
Monocle invites you to raise a glass of Glühwein at the annual Monocle Christmas Market. Please join us for this winter wonderland of a weekend, complete with warming treats from the Monocle Cafe, reindeer petting, and an appearance from Monochan the Owl, all set to a cheery playlist. You can also try your hand at our ever-popular tombola and meet our VIP Santa Claus all the way from Rovaniemi. The 2016 Monocle Christmas Market on Saturday the 3rd and Sunday the 4th of December from 11 a.m. to 1700 at our Midori House HQ here in Marylebone. Find all the details at monocle.com. We ho ho, hope to see you there.
Now we have to follow that. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, still with me, Michael Goldfarb and Victor Bulmer-Thomas. Now, even by the standards of a year in which electorates around the world have made some surprising decisions, last month's rejection of a peace deal by the people of Colombia was remarkable. Colombia's government and most observers assumed that the endorsement of a peace with narco-Marxist guerrillas FARC was a formality. Colombia's government has nevertheless announced that it will sign a deal anyway, albeit modified, with FARC, and that this one will be submitted to Congress rather than to the people. Victor, is there a lesson here?
Perhaps. Let's see what happens. But I think this is a case of the Colombian government making the best of a bad job and probably doing very much the right thing, which is that They listened to the result of the referendum. They went to their opponents, particularly former President Uribe, and they said, what do we have to do to change this agreement, to get your, if not complete support, at least, you know, qualified support? And then they went to the FARC and they sat down for 2 weeks and they came up with a set of modifications which are not cosmetic. I must stress that. These are not cosmetic changes. And it's possible that were they now to put this set of changes, which are quite substantial, to a new referendum, they might win it. But understandably, they think that's too risky and they're going to put it to Congress. And I think the view of the Colombian people, by the way, the agreement has been signed, was signed today. So it's that we know is done. I think the view of the Colombian people is going to be very much shrugging their shoulders, a little bit of tutting, but actually most of them probably quite grateful.
Michael, is there an argument here perhaps for the wisdom of crowds? Because FARC, it turns out, were willing to sign a worse deal from their point of view.
Well, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of it in that way. I mean, I think quite possibly, yes. I always think, when I think of this Colombia negotiation, I think of Northern Ireland. And in fact, there was a moment around the time of the Good Friday Agreement where Sinn Féin sent a delegation to Colombia to help try and get people out of the hole. And there was a lot of cynical commentary about that in the Belfast newspapers. I think it is interesting, and these changes, we speak of changes, but people who haven't been following, the changes are very interesting. For example, the FARC, which ultimately got involved in narco trafficking, they're going to have to put out a full accounting of their wealth, which I think is quite an extraordinary thing. There's a bit more amnesty, I think. Victor will know the details. A bit more amnesty for the federal army troops who were involved in some quite horrendous atrocities around the areas in which the FARC was operating. And all of that is important. But I think your question, Andrew, the idea that, in a negotiation, clearly President Santos, yes? Is that... And the FARC leadership really, more than anything, want to get this deal done. The FARC don't want to fight anymore. They want a way to become legitimate politicians. Santos is not particularly popular. He wants something to burnish his reputation so that when he faces elections in 18 months, is it? He has something to stand on. So I think that all of this motivated people. I think, it helps to get a deal done when the parties actually need to get it done.
Victor, Michael mentions there the comparison of Northern Ireland, and I wondered, do you think, is that applying here as well, that FARC understand what I think the brighter paramilitaries on both sides in Northern Ireland understood, which was that a large and growing plurality of the population were just sick to death of the whole thing and just wanted it to stop?
That's one factor. I think the other is that low-level violence had actually started breaking out despite the ceasefire. You will remember that after the referendum in Colombia, both sides agreed to continue the ceasefire regardless of the result. But of course, inevitably, it had started to break down in a very low-level way. But it isn't difficult to imagine that that could have got out of hand, particularly as there is still fighting going on between the government and the other guerrilla group, the ELN. So I think there was a real imperative on both sides to reach a new agreement that could be put to Congress and essentially become part of the law of the land, in addition to what you might call the popular expression of feeling.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will turn our attention to Japan, which is, of course, a country which has long since finished inventing everything we're ever actually going to need and now fills its days inventing stuff we don't. Panasonic plan to invest $60 million in Laundroid, a robot which will sort and fold your clothes. Michael, this will be available in March. Will you be ordering one?
Well, I have to say, I do wish that the great minds of our modern civilization, whether here or in Asia, would really address themselves to developing technologies that are important. However, having said that, folding laundry is a very, very tedious task for those of us who do it. And this is radio, so you can't see. Andrew clearly does
not.
Well,
I was just about to elaborate upon my solution for avoiding the tedium of sorting and folding one's laundry, which is don't.
Yes, but people don't know. And I suppose the next thing that Panasonic should invent is a good brush for your hair, Andrew, please. I mean, if you're going to have it long, brush it occasionally. I don't know. I think 60 million seems like a lot to those of us who don't earn much money. But really, 60 million for a new product launch in this day and age, they're not taking it seriously.
Victor, the developers of this prototype, a company called Seven Dreamers, claim that people spend 9,000 hours, which is 372 days of their average lifetime, folding clothes. Does that seem like a plausible estimate to you?
I have no idea. But what I think I would say is that we've always assumed that robots or other inventions that can save us time are, by their very nature, a good thing. Perhaps, but of course the corollary of that is if we're taking less exercise in the pursuit of these activities that robots then replace, we have to consume less calories on the other side. And there's absolutely no evidence that we're going to do so. So this will just add to the obesity problem. So maybe the solution for robots is to design ways in which we are forced to take more exercise. I'm always struck by when I worked in the United States, there was a sign in the car park of my university which said, please try and park as far away from the escalator as possible so you're forced to walk before you can get to your office. Well, I'm sure robots could come up with something.
Robot fitness instructor. I suspect that is probably something somebody is working on. Michael, what would you like them to build? What sort of robot would actually improve your life?
God, I think... You know, there's no clean answer to that. That's why when I knew we were going to be discussing this...
Those robots have already been invented.
I know. You know, going back, this is going back a very long time, but I remember living in Berkeley briefly in the early 1970s, and there was a guy I used to smoke pot with, and he was telling me about this incredible visualization machine he had just tried, you know, for something called virtual reality. And this is going back... 45 years. We all think it's, you know, now we're getting virtual reality things for Christmas. And the whole selling point for him was he could smoke a joint and then watch the most incredibly graphic pornography. And it was as good as having sex, and you didn't have the mess. And I technology is taking a wrong turn here.
Thinking more of sort of useful around the house kind of things, Victor. I'm trying to maintain a certain tone. Are there any sort of unfilled gaps in the market for domestic appliances?
Well, in my case, definitely, because I have 10,000 books and they accumulate a lot of dust. And every 2 years, I try and make sure that the dust is removed. And it's not a task that I am willing to entrust to anybody else, even if I could afford it. So I have to do it. And if a robot, under my personal supervision, of course,
obviously,
and obeying all my instructions, was willing to do it, provided I didn't have to pay for it, I would be very grateful.
Perhaps they could also build a robot which would oversee the other robot, but then presumably you would want to oversee that robot.
Oh, definitely.
See, at some point, Victor, you just have to let stuff go. That is all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Michael Goldfarb, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daphne Carnizas. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's more music next at 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.